It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pittsburgh Public Theater opens its new season September 27th with Pride and Prejudice. And for the first time in 19 years, with a new artistic director at the helm. Mariah C. Kaminsky is the new artistic director at The Public, and she joins us in studio now. Mariah, welcome to The Confluence.
Thanks, Kevin. It's great to be here.
Mariah, when you were interviewing for the job, prior to your being named, what sort of homework did you do on Pittsburgh in general and the theater community specifically?
Oh, thanks for asking. I did a lot of homework, including an under-the-radar visit here about a week before my interview, because I wanted to get a sense of what kind of town this is to make theater in. So that led me to exploring what the past is here and the sort of great foundations and the legacy of art here and these incredible arts institutions, but also speculating about the future of Pittsburgh. You know, I learned things like the downtown core is one of the fastest-growing populations in Pittsburgh. You know, I did some research into CMU and these great universities in the tech sector that's burgeoning here. So it seemed like a town with this really terrific past and dedication to the arts, but with a very promising future.
Well, you might have already just answered my next question. I mean, you had great success as associate artistic director with the Seattle Repertory Theater. So what was it that actually did bring you here?
Oh, thank you. Well, a little bit of personal and a little bit of professional. Personally, my sweetheart is from Pittsburgh, and we were very excited to sort of move back closer to family. And I'm from not too far from here, Rochester, New York, and have a big family there. But professionally, you know, I really get passionate about theater and think that theater is really moving towards something grand when it's working in a very local level, when it's resonating with a really energized local audience. And I really felt that when I came to Pittsburgh. You know, on that visit, you know, strangers were saying hi to me, were talking to me about going to The Public as kids. And it just felt like this was a town and a city where something really great could be built and could happen here.
You were at the O'Reilly Theater early this year when the annual announcement of the upcoming season was made. The outgoing artistic director of 18 years, Ted Pappas, told those gathered that The Public, quote, gets to grow in amazing ways I never even imagined, end quote. So how do you see it growing artistically as a major resource for the greater Pittsburgh community and even in terms of audience?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I mean, I think it's a question that major regional theaters are asking all over the country. How do we grow? How do we be responsive to a new generation of audiences? So for The Public, you know, I'm pretty lucky because Ted has an incredible legacy there, has built an amazing community there, and has really stewarded this passionate, devoted core audience. So that's an amazing platform to stretch open. When I think of artistic growth at The Public, I feel very dedicated to the diversity of programming there, the classics, the musicals, a new play now and again. But I am hoping to take those plays and stretch open the canon to include a new generation of artists, a more diverse representation of perspectives. And I think that if we do that work on the stage, that it's possible we'll see that also happen in the audience.
Right. So even before you were officially artistic director, actually came here and took over, you selected, played a major part in selecting the majority of this season. What did you have in mind as a whole for the season in your selections?
Yeah. You know, I was really drawn to what I consider a classic. So what I consider a classic is a play that is entertaining, beautifully written, but also deals with very big ideas. So, you know, we have some traditional classics in the season. Pride and Prejudice, Tempest, even A Doll's House Part II is a reference to this really classic canonical literature. But there are some new classics in the season, too. Sweat by Lynn Nottage won the Pulitzer last year and is set not too far from here in Reading, Pennsylvania. And this is, I believe, a true new American classic about a group of friends that hang out at a local bar, work at the local steel tubing factory, and then face layoffs and lockouts and have to decide how to stay friends and how to struggle forward.
Where have we heard that story before?
I know. It seemed like something that would resonate. So when I thought about the season, I'm attracted to those big ideas and hopefully stories that resonate on a local level, but also ones that are very entertaining. I think that's really what we need right now.
In hearing you, it obviously is a classic does not need to be a certain age, shall we say. It doesn't have to be around for decades and decades.
Well, I actually think that's our job right now in the American theater, is to curate a sort of new generation of classics and keep those, keep Miller, keep Austin, keep Tennessee Williams close, but also make some space for these incredible, extraordinary playwrights working right now, like Lynn Nottage.
Mm-hmm. You talked about big ideas. So the new season includes Pride and Prejudice, as you mentioned, Sweat, The Tempest, A Doll's House Part Two, and Indecent, Marjorie Prime. So do you see a linkage among all of the plays?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I do think the linkage is that they all deal with big ideas. And in many ways, they all deal with historical moments, right? Whether they are a historical classic like Pride and Prejudice, seen through a very new lens with mm-hmm. this adaptation by Kate Hamill, or a play like Indecent, right? Which is based on a true story about a Jewish theater troupe in 1923 who brought this beautiful play to Broadway that was closed down for indecency. And this theater troupe, the story is really about these seven people and how their devotion and passion for their art see them through these tumultuous times in the world. So to me, even though Indecent might not be considered a classic, it's about this amazing historical moment that resonates now in so many ways.
So that Indecent is a play about a play in essence, but it's also a love story, but scandalous because it wasn't the traditional love story.
It was not a traditional love story. It's the play within the play was written by Jewish playwright Sholem Ash and is about two women who fall in love, which of course is why it was closed down on Broadway in 1923. So we are bringing that story back. And it's funny, you know, the thing about that play and the thing I love about it is that it is sublimely theatrical. Seven actors play over 40 roles. So while it's about this sort of heavy, you know, complex material, there is a flavor of real sort of acrobatic entertainment to it. Oh, and it's all set to live klezmer music.
Klezmer music is fantastic. It really is.
Indeed. I've learned a lot about it in the last few months.
So how do the past and not necessarily the present, but maybe, but also the future come into play with this group of productions that you'll be doing over the course of the year?
Wow. That's sort of a poetic question, Kevin. Mm-hmm. Thank you. To me, I think theater, probably all art, but theater, since that's the form I get to work in, is always teetering on that, is always teetering on the past and the future, right? On tradition and this incredible legacy of craft, particularly at a place like the Public. But how do we be responsive, right, to the new ways that audiences want to be entertained, are consuming entertainment, are interacting with technology, are interacting with their families? So I think we do address that in the season, but I'm actually interested in addressing it in a bigger way, too. I think theater for the next generation, I think it's about taking those beautiful, extraordinary collaborations beyond the rehearsal room into the community and thinking of theater more like a public commons, right, where everybody can come. We can come enjoy a story about something that resonates and makes us laugh, which I think is a rare circumstance in the world today.
You talked about familiar classics. Familiar can be sort of comforting. It's sort of our safety net, but told in an unexpected way, which can be exciting, mysterious. Can it be risky?
Of course. Indeed. And, you know, it's interesting about classics. You know, there's a reason they last. I think there is a comfort to knowing the story, being well-versed in that story, and seeing new interpretations. But art is all about risk, right? I mean, I think that's a core value to what an actor does every time they get on the stage. Having some component of risk in how we're curating those stories and how we're thinking about the interaction with the audience, I think is part of our job.
Use the word diversity earlier. One thing that definitely stands out in this collection this season is the prominence of the women artists. Four of the plays directed by women, including two by you. Four of the plays were written or are adaptations by women, including your adaptation of The Tempest, which has a woman in the traditional male role of the lead character. So seems like a conscious decision. Was this part of the diversity?
It definitely was. Though I will say, you know, if you count Shakespeare as one of our playwrights this season, it's really half and half.
Okay.
but yes, I mean, not only thinking about the stories we're putting on stage, but I think to engage a modern audience, we also have to think about who's making those stories and who's telling them. So yes, there's, I think, a really exciting representation of women. There's also diverse representation in terms of the artists, the directors, and the playwrights involved in terms of sexual orientation, race, culture, perspective. I think that's essential. And it's funny, you know, I don't think it's essential necessarily because it's time to center women's voices. Mm-hmm. I actually think what's essential is it's time to acknowledge that women can also write universal stories, right? That these aren't stories about women, they're about the human experience. And they do happen to be written by a diverse selection of perspectives.
Less than 2 minutes left. I want to ask you, so is this stretching the envelope? Is it an effort to stretch artistically, attract a younger audience? And if so, how do you hold on to your core audience?
What a great question. I mean, I confess, you know, I'm really still getting to know Pittsburgh and still getting to know our core audience. While it was a great privilege to plan this season, I did it with a lot left to learn. But from what I know of the core audience, they seem passionate, they seem devoted, and they seem adventuresome. Not only our core audience, but audiences in Pittsburgh. And I think there is a thirst. I think that theater is better when there are diverse perspectives represented both on stage and in the audience. So I think the core audience is going to come along. I hope.
Okay. In our final 30 seconds, Mariah, among other things, you were known for getting the community involved with the Seattle Repertory Theater, literally on stage. 30 seconds to tell us your plans to get the Pittsburgh community more involved with the public.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I mentioned that the collaborations we're working on are not only in the rehearsal room, but in the community.
Right.
So you'll see a lot of examples of that in our season, including we're collaborating with the Pittsburgh Youth Choir. They'll be featured heavily in our production of The Tempest. And we are also collaborating with the tech sector. So folks like Ascender Start Build Hub, the Thrival Festival, you'll still see will be a presence at the Thrival Festival in September, September 19th and 20th. So I think it's stretching those collaborations into the community is how to really engage.
So it seems like in your very short time here, you've been really reaching out.
I've been busy. I've been trying to stay busy. Yeah.
Mariah C. Kaminsky is the new artistic director at the Pittsburgh Public Theater. Mariah, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here, Kevin.
I'm Megan Harris. Still ahead on The Confluence, sexual assault can lead to loss of income and expensive health issues. But of the more than 1,000 victims documented in Pennsylvania's grand jury report on clergy sex abuse, just a handful can bring civil lawsuits, which could lead to financial restitution. We check in on the legal ramifications of an Allegheny County Police Review Board, one state's abolition of a cash bail system, and alleged misconduct by a city police officer against a local activist. Plus a look at what life would be like without legal abortion access in Pittsburgh. Stick with us as The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
You'd be hard-pressed to find a radio station spinning the Rolling Stones' Street Fighting Man 50 years ago today. The song, released just 2 days after the conclusion of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, was refused airplay by most radio stations in America, fearing it would incite more violence in the streets. The song was one of the Stones' last political songs, a smart move for the band as songs about love, rock and roll, and loving rock and roll made them favorites on both sides of the aisle. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
This is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Today, in an encore presentation of a story that first aired in August 2017, Rocco Tomboski of Squirrel Hill explains what drives her to advocate for the seniors in her neighborhood and beyond.
Rocco Tomboski was born in California, but she and her parents moved to Squirrel Hill while she was still young to become part of the Jewish community there.
They came here for the schooling. I grew up here, went to the yeshiva, and got married, and I'm here now. I'm a mother of eight, oldest being 20, turning 21, youngest is three.
Despite the busy home life, since June of 2015, Tomboski has found the time to run the nonprofit group Giving It Forward Together, or GIFT. The organization engages seniors who are homebound or living in a senior community by providing them with opportunities to give back to their own neighborhoods. Tomboski says GIFT's programs tap into seniors' abilities to stay active in the community.
So there's tons, and thankfully, I mean, we need that, tons of agencies capitalizing on what seniors can't do, but is anyone focusing on what seniors can still do?
That can be anything from filling backpacks with school supplies for disadvantaged children to preparing holiday meals for other seniors. GIFT also has a program in which seniors help get shelter pets acclimated to human contact. Tomboski says GIFT's holiday meal packages have been especially appreciated. Here, she reads a thank you note written by the caregiver of a solitary homebound senior.
I surprised her and set the table, and when she came in, she was overwhelmed to see the table looking like a true Passover Seder should look. It brought tears to her eyes. Thank you to all who made that possible.
GIFT's home base of Squirrel Hill has an especially large senior population. First of all, it's a big place, covering almost 4 square miles in the East End. With a population of more than 26,000, about 1 in 12 Pittsburghers hails from the neighborhood. And as of the 2010 census, about 35% of Squirrel Hill residents were over the age of 60. But Tomboski says there's plenty of need for engaging the elderly in other areas, too, so she's taken GIFT programs to Rankin, Braddock, Oakland, the Southside, and others.
When we're dealing with our elderly community, the feeling of loneliness it hits everybody, meaning that even if you're wealthy or even if you're poor, when you're a homebound senior, it doesn't matter what you have in your bank.
Calling seniors the forgotten demographic, Tomboski says she thinks ageism is a problem entrenched in American culture. To help change attitudes, she's launching a new program in which college-age volunteers will visit homebound seniors. It's called Just Say Shalom.
If I can work now with college-age students, that when they get older and they're the ones that are giving grant money and they're giving funding, they're going to remember their experience and how these are real people that are the ones that actually laid out where we are today, right? They're the ones that did all the hard work so that we are here today. Shouldn't we be giving them thanks?
For 90.5 WESA News, I'm Noah Broad.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Being sexually abused as a child can shape someone's entire life. Their health, relationships, spirituality, and the loss of income can be enormous. Yet, of the more than 1,000 victims documented in the Pennsylvania Grand Jury Report on Clergy Sex Abuse, only 2 can bring civil lawsuits which could lead to financial restitution. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden reports on the long-term monetary costs for victims.
When Ray Santori was 10, his mother died. His father had died the year before, so an aunt and uncle near Pittsburgh took him in. At St. Bernadette's Church in Monroeville, Pennsylvania, Santori met Father William Yockey, who, according to the grand jury report, sexually assaulted him for about 2 years.
I mean, I sometimes couldn't look people in the eye because they would know.
Santori started drinking, using drugs, ended up leaving the house before finishing high school. He's been homeless, incarcerated.
I felt that everybody knew that I was sexually abused.
Today, Santori says he's 26 months sober and makes a decent living as a carpenter. But economically, the 53-year-old is not in good shape.
The sexual abuse drove me into such a dark place that it was hard to get a grip on responsibility, reality, you know, saving money.
During more than 3 decades of addiction, Santori estimates he spent up to $2 million on drugs and alcohol.
I know this, I'll probably have to work till the day I die.
Many survivors of clergy sex abuse struggle financially. Health economist Derek Brown at Washington University in St. Louis specializes in studying the effects of child maltreatment. This spring, he published research on the lifetime financial burden of child sex abuse.
We can compare it to, say, costs of disease, you know, to other kinds of injury or illness.
Brown factored in things like medical care and quality of life. Per individual, this loss averages more than $80,000. And that's not including loss of income. All told, the financial effects can average more than $300,000.
If you have a modest impact of a few thousand dollars a year in earnings, but that accumulates over the life cycle, you have 40 plus years of those impacts for a victim.
Survivors of sex abuse often develop depression and anxiety, which affects their performance at work or school.
And then there's reminders all around us.
Psychologist Tom Plant at Santa Clara University researches clergy sexual assault.
Maybe you drive by a church or you see you're watching a movie and all of a sudden a priest shows up in the movie, or you are asked to attend a wedding or a funeral.
Plant says while sexual assault of any kind is traumatizing, with clergy offenders, they're often seen as these godlike leaders whom no one questions. As a result, he says, many victims develop issues with hierarchy, which career-wise is problematic.
They may have troubles or issues with, you know, the boss at work because it's hard for them to potentially trust those who have authority and power.
Plant says it's hard to always draw a clear connection since perpetrators tend to target kids like Ray Santori who are already troubled. And Santori isn't positive the abuse led him to blowing millions of dollars on drugs and alcohol.
But I definitely look back and am disheartened by how quick the time passed and how far behind the game I am.
At this point, Santori says there's nothing he can do but keep moving forward. I'm Sarah Bowden, 90.5 WESA News.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Several interesting developments recently in the justice system, and we brought in WESA's legal analyst, David Harris, host of the podcast Criminal Injustice. Hello, David.
Good to be with you, Kevin.
Allegheny County Council held its first public hearings on a proposal to create a countywide civilian police review board to examine claims of police misconduct. David, what are the chances that it would be a true investigative board? Because there are 106 police forces, each of them would have to agree, wouldn't they?
Well, that's correct, Kevin. And this has all followed the groundswell of public resentment and anger after the killing of Antoine Rose back in June by a police officer from one of our smaller communities in Allegheny County. And so the question is, can we have some kind of a body that would supply public oversight, civilian oversight, the same way that the Citizens Police Review Board does for the Pittsburgh Police Department? And there are legal roadblocks to this because the county does not have the authority to make all the 100-plus small police departments become part of or under the authority of a review board. So we have to be inventive if this is going to work. This county can set up a review board or other kind of accountability mechanism that would cover the county police, but to get the small communities in, you have to do something else.
The county police, though, they're really investigative. They're not first encounter.
Right, right. So they aren't the people the agency you'd really be most concerned about. It's these other 100-plus small departments. And we learned as part of the investigation into the Rose killing that the East Pittsburgh police didn't even have some basic policies. So there are real concerns here. And in order to get these small communities in, you either have to do that through creating a body and public pressure to get them all to come in, or you have to create some kinds of incentives, or you go to the state legislature and you ask them to change the law.
Is there a move at the state level?
There is. Senator Fontana from Allegheny County, he has put a bill in that would allow Allegheny County to require all of the police departments in its jurisdiction to become part of a civilian oversight authority. That's probably the best and the cleanest way to do it. Other than that, you set it up and you get these agencies to come in, be a part of it because they gain something from it.
So you incentivize. But are there other options other than the Pittsburgh type board?
Absolutely. There are at least three models here. You could have a complaint review board that does original investigations, makes findings. You could do a board that just reviews the investigations done by the police departments themselves. And then third, you could do an auditor or monitor type authority that would look at the full functioning of the police department, whether it's use of force policies, the way it handles complaints, the way it deploys officers, or even pays them. So you could have any number of choices of functions and forms. The question is to find the best kind of fit for our jurisdiction. So this is the beginning of the process. I'm hopeful that they can create something that will incentivize the small communities to come in if they can't force them through state legislation.
Let's talk about a recent encounter between a city police officer and Leon Ford, the young man who recently, earlier this year, reached a $5.5 million settlement with the city of Pittsburgh after being paralyzed from being shot by another officer several years ago. Ford said he smiled at the officer who he said glared at him, and allegedly the officer said, "You just want another check." Now, Leon Ford said the officer was not wearing a name badge and refused to identify himself. Why is this important, David?
It's important, and you saw the reaction of the police department pretty immediately. There was video of this. They reacted right away by saying that to not wear a name tag and to refuse to identify oneself when requested, these were violations of department policy, and it was being investigated as such. Why would they care about that, though? This makes a big difference to how the public perceives police officers. If the member of the public can easily identify the person, that way if there was some kind of dissatisfaction with the encounter, the member of the public could complain. Without identification, if that can be withheld, you get the feeling as a member of the public that maybe this officer can act with impunity. And the department knows this. The department knows it needs the support and trust of the community. So that's why the department itself requires identification in the form of badges or giving one's name when requested. They want the public support. And so even one little incident can tip the scales in the wrong direction. You don't want that.
So it doesn't have to be a physical encounter to worsen police-community relations.
Oh, absolutely not. And especially with somebody like Leon Ford. He's out in the community. He's well-known. He has suffered a very, very serious setback in his life. If something happens with him, everybody's going to know it. And that's exactly what happened here. And so the police department has responded. One hopes they would respond to any citizen in exactly the same way.
Let's talk a little bit about eliminating cash bail. California will become the first state in the nation to abolish cash bail for suspects awaiting trial. Governor Jerry Brown recently signed a bill. Supporters of this reform say it's a fairness issue. Poor defendants just can't afford to pay the cash bail. Wealthier ones can.
This is important as a fairness issue, as you know, from the first stage. When we have cash bail, and that's been the tradition in this country in 50 states for many, many years, we are with one other country in the world, and that's the Philippines. The problem with the cash bail system is that people get detained prior to trial because they can't pay very low amounts of bail. I'm talking $50, $100, $200. And they get detained whether they're as innocent as the day they were born. If they can't pay that money, they stay in. On the other hand, guilty though they might be, if you can pay the money, you get out. And there's just something that's fundamentally unfair with that. It also bulks up the jail populations in whatever county you're talking about enormously. So there's been a lot of pressure and interest on getting rid of cash bail so that you can take jail populations down, save the taxpayer money, and still get people coming to court.
So Washington, D.C. has a no cash bail policy. How has that been working?
They've had that for decades, and it works just fine. They don't use cash bail. They either detain you because you're a risk or they don't. And they get the same rate or better of people showing up for court, and they have no more people reoffending when they're released than in any other jurisdiction. In fact, they do somewhat better on both of those scores.
What about Pennsylvania? I know New Jersey is relying less on cash bail, but what about Pennsylvania? Is there any consideration to do something like relying less or even a no cash bail, period?
There are activist groups. The ACLU is out there, some others, and eliminating cash bail throughout the state is one of the priorities of reform-minded people who are interested in criminal justice. As far as I know, there's no proposal in the legislature that has gotten significant traction yet. Everybody is looking at the neighboring state of New Jersey, as you mentioned, because they have a big experiment underway. And so far in the first year, the results seem quite good. Their jail populations are low, and they have not have a mass outbreak of reoffending or people not showing up for court.
But is that helping the poor defendants, the less reliance on the cash bail?
Yes, it does, because, and there's data that goes back years on this, because when you're locked up prior to trial, you can't help your own defense. You get worse plea offers. People end up going to jail more often and for longer. Those things are strongly related to being detained before trial because you have no money. And nobody thinks a system that relies on money to judge those things is fair. So this is the kind of move I think that's afoot in the country at large. The process should be more fair and have less of a disparate impact on people just because they're poor.
University of Pittsburgh Law Professor David Harris is WESA's legal analyst. David, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. President Trump's pick for the Supreme Court begins his Senate confirmation hearing on Capitol Hill today. If confirmed, Judge Brett Kavanaugh will tip the court to the right and make overturning Roe v. Wade a possibility. 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins looks at how that could affect Pennsylvania.
It began like any civilized debate about abortion.
The floodgates of outrage opened.
Are you ready to defend Roe versus Wade?
Now the fight over confirming Brett Kavanaugh begins.
There are already abortion cases in the pipeline that could reach the Supreme Court in the next couple years. And the court could change abortion laws in a couple different ways if it overturns Roe versus Wade. One scenario that really freaks out abortion rights activists is a ruling that says abortion is not a constitutional right. That would mean it would be up to states to legalize or ban abortion. So what would happen in Pennsylvania? Long story short, abortion would still be legal here. But
we return more or less to a situation like what we had before Roe was decided in the early 70s.
That's Jessica Ahrens with the ACLU. She estimates that almost half of states would ban abortion outright if Roe is overturned.
Another handful of states would protect it very explicitly, and a lot more would be in the middle, and Pennsylvania among them.
Sue Fritchie of the Women's Law Project agrees. She says that Pennsylvania doesn't have a trigger law that would immediately ban abortion, but it does have a convoluted patchwork of abortion restrictions.
We have tons of those kinds of laws. We don't have a law that generally criminalizes abortion, and I certainly hope we never do.
By that same token, we don't have a law that protects abortion.
Right.
Here's the list of Pennsylvania's abortion regulations. Abortions after 24 weeks are illegal, unless the life of the mother is in danger. Abortions based on the sex of the fetus are illegal. A minor needs parental consent unless she gets a waiver from a judge. Doctors must read a script to the patient that explains fetal development and the financial assistance that's available if she continues the pregnancy. And there's a mandatory 24-hour waiting period after that counseling session before she can have the procedure.
Please turn away.
Come on, man!
There are other options.
Every week, anti-abortion activists stand outside a Pittsburgh clinic that provides the procedure. They've protested here for decades, and they'll likely still come here if Roe is overturned. Protester Andrew Badiato comes here with his wife and baby most Saturdays.
We will be so excited when this stops, but that it by no means is the end. You know, if abortion is banned outright, will it still happen? And I think most likely yes.
Horatio Mihaut with Liberty Counsel says the court could go further and do more than just overturn Roe.
If the rationale of the Supreme Court would be that Roe versus Wade was incorrectly decided because an unborn human being has a right to life under the Constitution, then no state could continue to allow abortions.
Mihet opposes abortion rights, but he and Jessica Ahrens at the ACLU do agree on one thing. It's highly unlikely the court would outlaw abortion outright.
Chief Justice Roberts in particular is, I think, very savvy. So I think he's going to look for incremental opportunities to reduce the right to abortion and the access to abortion care rather than want to go, you know, whole hog.
If Roe is overturned, the issue would return to Harrisburg, where Republicans control the legislature. Democratic Governor Tom Wolf supports abortion rights. His Republican opponent this November, Scott Wagner, has said he supports pro-life legislation. The winner of their race could decide whether abortion law will go back to where it was 45 years ago. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
And joining me in studio now to dig a little deeper into what's ahead for this series is Lucy Perkins. Lucy, thanks so much for being here.
Sure.
So you tell a story in four parts. Today, a look at the law, potential ways it could change. Give us a preview of what's coming up in the days ahead.
Sure. So today we heard about the legislation that is currently in place, which we realize there isn't much of in Pennsylvania. And tomorrow we'll go back to what legislation was in place before the Roe decision. So at that point, abortion was illegal in Pennsylvania, and we will be talking to some doctors and nurses and members of the medical community in Pittsburgh who will talk to us about how they found a legal loophole to perform what they deemed as lawful abortions before abortion was legal.
So they were official illegal, but they found a legal loophole.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. The law they thought was vague. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of pushback from the anti-abortion rights side of things. But that's what some doctors were doing here. Later in the week, we will also speak to anti-abortion rights activists. Pittsburgh happened to be home to one of the largest protest movements in the country, and other cities throughout the U.S. ended up looking toward this movement in Pittsburgh for useful tactics as far as, you know, blocking clinic doors and things like that. So that's another aspect of this series. And then finally, we're going to look at the landmark Supreme Court decision, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which, of course, came out of Pennsylvania.
Former Governor Casey, the father of current U.S. Senator Bob Casey.
Right. So that 1992 case actually kind of set the groundwork for a lot of the abortion regulation that we are seeing across the country today.
So as you researched, as you did your interviews for this series, Lucy, how are advocates on both sides of the debate sort of gearing up for the potential legal challenges?
Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of what you would expect. People who are on the abortion rights side of things are pretty upset with Judge Kavanaugh's nomination. And people on the anti-abortion rights side of things are, you know, really hoping that he will be confirmed quickly.
Can they sort of wage a war of perception now, appealing to people who might be willing to reach out to our lawmakers, candidates, the media?
You know, as with any issue, people are welcome to reach out to their lawmakers, specifically senators, because this is a Senate confirmation hearing that Judge Kavanaugh is, you know, going through this week. But, ultimately it does come down to math. So they need 51 senators to confirm Judge Kavanaugh. And right now, as far as if everyone votes on party lines, that will happen because there are enough Republican senators to do that.
We have just about a minute left. Regardless whether Judge Kavanaugh is confirmed, how soon could a case challenging Roe be presented to the full Supreme Court?
Well, I talked to a bunch of different experts on both sides of this issue. Everyone was pretty hesitant to speculate when it comes to that timeline. But, you know, some people said within the next couple of years. So, you know, we could see something that might not directly address Roe, but be on the abortion issue that the justices could hear within the next couple of years.
Yeah, there are cases in the federal court system. It's at what stage they are, how quickly those courts respond to it, how they act, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So that's what people will be watching the court for in the next couple of years.
All right. Lucy Perkins is a reporter, producer on WESA's government and accountability team. Lucy, thanks so much. We can't wait to hear more.
You're welcome.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next show, we'll talk with University of Pittsburgh Athletic Director Heather Like about the Pitt-Penn State rivalry, paying college athletes, and compliance with Title IX. Plus, Pittsburgh as a jazz hub, looking to establish an economic ecosystem to foster the local jazz community. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.